Okay. That's the key word to tell them that to turn on the tape recording. My name is Laurie. I'm a compulsive overeater. And this, again, is a big book study. Today we'll be discussing step four in this session. I'm going to be discussing the big book, and much of what I say and much of what I'm about to say can be found on a website. There are all kinds of free downloads, and the website is oabigbook.info, oabigbook, one word, .info. And you'll be able to find downloads, including the forms that I'll be discussing in this particular session, the step four forms. In the session earlier, I discussed steps one, two, and three from the big book. And I said that step one gives us hopelessness, step two gives us hope, step three is the decision that we make. And now it's time, the decision we make to find our higher power, to get our connection with the power that's deep down within us. And that connection can only be found, the big book says, and we agnostics, by getting rid of the things that obscure us from the deep values that are deep within us. And that is to be done by searching fearlessly. We have to get rid of the things that obscure us. They talk about that as being calamity, pomp, and worship of other things. And the big book says that step four is a beginning. In how it works, it says we started upon a personal inventory. This was step four. So even though the word, as the steps are written on the wall, the word inventory only occurs in step four and then again in step 10, it turns out that steps 4 through 9 are the process by which we do our inventory. Because they describe an inventory in the big book as a process of, do Americans say process or process? I can't.
Process.
Oh, you say process. Okay. Yeah, I am a Canadian. Oh, I'm a Canadian.
It's all right.
Yeah. You can tell I'm a Canadian by my lack of accent. We actually have the purest vowel sounds. Midwestern Canadians have the purest vowel sounds. An a is an a, it's not an a or anything like that. But anyway, the big book says the big book describes an inventory as the process by which we identify and then get rid of the things that are blocking us from the sunlight of the spirit. So in steps 4 and 5, we identify them. In steps 6 and 7, we're ready to get rid of them. And in steps 8 and 9, we get rid of them. That's the process that's described. And the big book makes it clear by giving us the promises in step 9, after the discussion of step 9, that tells us how we're going to feel at the end of step 9. And there are no promises in steps 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 that are anywhere near what a spiritual awakening is. So if we look at from the big book perspective that step 4 is only the beginning of the inventory, we'll get an understanding of actually of step 10 as well, but we'll get an understanding of what's going on and why we're doing this each time. Now, the big book has a particular method of doing step 4. I find it really valuable. I have found most people I've talked to who've used them have found it very valuable. There are many ways of doing step 4, and I'm not going to say that any other way is a bad way. It works for some people. That's wonderful. And tonight, when I talk in a more generic sense about steps 4 through 11, I will say that as well. And I won't talk about what I'm about to talk about here. Because how you do the steps is a matter of your own personal preference. The reason I like the big book approach is that it's relatively quick. And you get recovered, you become recovered relatively quickly if you work these steps the way the big book describes it. But many other people have done the steps in other ways and have done step 4 in other ways, and it gives them the same sense of completion, and that's wonderful. But at this session, I'm just going to describe the big book approach. There are forms that you can get on the website that allow you to do this actually on your computer if you want to. It's the PDF files that you can write in. Or you can just print them and write on the files. But I'm just going to describe the process. I wish I didn't have to suck on this lozenge, but my throat is not good. So the big book separates the problems we have and has us fill out 3 different pieces of paper. The first is what the Big Book calls resentments. And I find it very helpful to take that as a generic sense from the Latin resentira, which is the root of resentment, re meaning again, and sentira is to feel. So to feel again, a resentment is something that you feel over and over again. It's the things that are clogging up your mind, the things that are on your mind right now, the what-ifs and the if-onlys of your life, the things that bother you. And these things are, you're going to discover, are killing you, even though you may not realize that they are. That's what the form actually shows you as you go through the form. So the first thing you do is you deal with resentments. The second thing you do is deal with fears, and the third thing you do is deal with what the Big Book calls sex conduct. And I'll talk about each one of those in turn. But the resentment part, the Big Book says, is the most important because it is the expression of our wanting to be the directors instead of the actors. A resentment is exactly our reaction to life going on not the way we want it to. I mean, that's what a resentment is. Life isn't going on the way I want it to. Life didn't go on the way I wanted it to. Life isn't going on the way I want it to. Life won't go on the way I want it to. And therefore, I resent it. And I did things that I shouldn't have done. I didn't do things I should have done. People did things to me they shouldn't have done. People didn't do things they should have done. I mean, that's life. Life is going on. Life stinks. That's the general thing. Life just isn't going my way. And the Big Book says, I mean, that is a resentment. And the first thing you do is just write them down. You write them down in a column, column one. You just write down your resentments. Leave space between them. The form allows you to do that, provide space. But leave space between them so that you'll have a chance to fill in the rest of the columns, which require a little bit more writing. But you just write down your resentments. You write down people, my wife, my father, my mother, my sister, my brother, my girlfriend, my boyfriend, my, you know, talk show hosts, particular talk show hosts, particular presidents, particular evil dictators, particular whatever. You know, the professor who failed me in course, the teacher who laughed at me when I wanted to sign up for the football team. That's me. I put down Hitler. I've put down ex-girlfriends, I've put down people I wronged, and I put down people who wronged me. Institutions, I put down as being a lawyer, I put down justice, the justice system. I put down the penal system. I put down some institutions like a university that bothered me or a particular group of people that bothered me. And then it says also put down principles. And it doesn't explain what a principle is, but I think a principle is something like life sucks and then you die. There will always be poor people in this world. Suffering is going on throughout this world. I'm never going to lose weight. I failed so many times. I'm a failure in life. Now, you'll see that the Big Book does not suggest that you put yourself down. But I do put things about myself down, but I don't put myself down. There's a reason for that when we get to steps 8 and 9. The Big Book never suggests making amends to yourself. I mean, we hear in this program, I've heard so often, the first person I have to make amends to is myself. Absolutely not from the Big Book perspective. You make an amend to yourself only by changing your whole personality and becoming a different person. That's a pretty good amend. You become a good person. That's the amend you make to yourself. But you don't make amends to yourself in any other way. I'll talk about that, and I talk about the need for bubble baths and incense later. And I mean, there is a need for it. I'm not saying that sometimes you need time for yourself. Sometimes you need to be able to say no. But the reason you do that is to help other people, not to help yourself. Anyway, so I put down principles. And I have put down principles like, I don't know why I'm doing this stupid inventory. And I put principles down like, I don't like this OA meeting. I don't like this person in OA. I put down the stupidest things and I put down the deepest things. From Hitler to the guy who cut me off at the corner when I was trying to drive. And I'm telling you, I just did an inventory, and I'll talk about that more when I get to step 10. I just did one. And life is going pretty well for me right now, but I just didn't have an edge. And I just felt restless, irritable, and discontented. So I did an inventory. I had 30 resentments. And they were all stupid. I mean, once I wrote them down, I realized they were stupid. But they were in my mind. No wonder they're clouding up my mind. You know, if I've got that, and once you put them down, they actually, that gives you a sense of release almost right at that moment because you've written them down. My advice, my experience says that if you write them down in an evening and then you go to the next day, you'll find some more. Because once you've put the things that are really on the surface, you put them on paper, it'll allow you to remember more the next day. So that's the first thing you do. Make that sheet. Fill out those sheets, first column. The second column is you write out why those things are on your mind. This is the venting time. This is the time for you to write out, why are these things on my mind? And the big book has an actual picture of that, and it suggests that you use just very succinct, very concise description. Don't write a novel. And as it turns out, in step five, you won't be writing this down. You won't be giving this off to anyone. You can just write down in point form. I heard one big book study where the speaker said, he said, the big book, the longest sentence in that second column is 19 words. I allow my sponsees 20. So the whole sense is you just write down in point form what bothers you. For the guy who cut me off, it might be as simple as he could have killed me. And then I might go drill down. I might say he could kill others. I didn't do anything. I didn't get his license plate. I don't know. It might be as simple as that. I don't want to talk about other people in my life, but let's assume, there can be a wife, and this is not my wife, but, you know, spends too much, wants to do so much work in the house. I can't work anymore. I can't earn any more money, not enough sex, whatever, you know, things like that. You put those things down. So those are pretty deep. For a mother, I've heard enough step five inventories to know that some people would put down, hated me as a child, always made fun, kept trying to make me lose weight, kept telling me I was no good, things like that. For Hitler, responsible for the death of millions. Crazy. Was able to persuade people that he was right. I put down a number of things, but they were all point form. I could write a novel. Well, no, I can't actually. I've tried to and I can't. But I could try and write a novel. I could certainly write a lot and talk a lot about some incidents in my life that were sort of life-changing. You know, if only I'd done this and I didn't. And I could just write down that incident. That's enough for me. I know what that's about. So I'm just suggesting a point form. And you'll find that that's really good. That's a venting feeling. And you get down some things, some of which are really stupid and some of which are really deep. You know, I mean, it's very deep. Was responsible for the death of millions of people. It's deep. It's not anything that's stupid to put down. That really did. I resent that. It's something that was deep in my heart that just absolutely killed me that so many millions of people died as a result of the craziness and hatred of one person. Then I've also written down a bunch of other people who are responsible for the death of millions of people too. That's deep. And then the guy who, you know, snubbed me at a party, not so deep, you know, or the teacher who laughed at me when I tried to join the football team. Not so deep, not a big deal in retrospect, but I still wrote it down. So you're venting. That's the second column. The third column has six different subdivisions, and the big book talks about it as, I'm trying to remember the order, self-esteem, pocketbooks or security issues, safety issues, ambitions, personal relations, sex relations, and is there any fear involved? And the forms that are available on the website have places for check marks. All you do is check, whether they apply. So for each of the points that you've got in the second column. So, for instance, I have with Hitler responsible for the death of millions of people and was able to persuade people that he was right. Two completely separate points, right? So I might say, does that affect my self-esteem that he was responsible for the death of millions of people? Actually, at one time I might have said yes because I would have said, well, I didn't die in the war. I didn't die as a result, and I sort of feel lesser. I don't know, but that's esoteric. So I would probably say no, it doesn't affect my self-esteem. That other people could be persuaded wouldn't affect my self-esteem. But down to the friend who stubbed me at a party affected my self-esteem. So I'd put a check mark only where it fits. And I prefer to go down that sub column and go down and see for beside each of the points whether or not my self-esteem was affected. So I put a check mark beside that. Then I look at, and I go through all of those. You always fill the columns down. You don't fill them across. So then I go through the column on security or pocketbooks. Response to the death of millions of people, that affected my security. It has all my life. I felt unsafe. And security and pocketbooks meaning money, being only one aspect of security, I felt unsafe as a result. Was able to persuade millions of people that he was right. I feel unsafe as a result of that. Because if he could do it, other people can do it. The guy who stubbed me didn't affect my sense of security. So just go down that list, okay? The mother who hated me affected my self-esteem, may have affected my security. Maybe the reason that she hated me has affected my ability to earn money. So maybe it affected my security. Okay, you get that sense? The third column is ambitions, and almost always you'll find your ambitions have been in some way affected because they're on your list. You wish it hadn't happened, right? So you'll check off ambitions almost always. This sounds like rote, right? It sounds like almost mechanical, and it is. That's why it's so simple, and that's why it works so well. Because these aren't the big columns. These are just columns that you just fill out, but you think about each one. So you got ambitions. The next is personal relations. Where are my personal relations affected? Well, Hitler, I don't think affected my personal relations in many ways. Although I imagine if one of the people at work happened to be a neo-Nazi, I would say yes, it affects my personal relations. So it just depends on my situation as to whether it might affect it. Or if one of my acquaintances, it doesn't matter, but you understand what I'm saying. So you just do check marks down there. Sex relations, check marks down there. Or not. And then is any fear involved? And you just put the check marks there. And then the big book says this. It says, we're now at a point where we can see that the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real, was killing us, had the power to kill us. Because you're going to see all those check marks, and there should be a lot of them. And you're going to see that your life, how you feel about yourself, your self-esteem, how safe you feel, either financially or any other way, what you want out of life, your ambitions, your relationships with other people, your sex relations, are all affected, and you're going to see a whole bunch of check marks, and you're going to realize how in the world can you function if all these things have been affected by all these things that are going around and around and around in your mind. It's an amazing experience the first time you do it. And I know there are people here who have used those forms, right? Anyone? And isn't it an amazing experience when you do it? I mean, you just sort of, my goodness, no wonder my mind is in terrible shape. Because not only are these things on my mind, these people, these institutions and principles on my mind, but they're killing me. They're affecting how I feel about myself and about life. They're affecting my relationships with other people. And you're going to be emboldened to go forward on the next part of this step, which is a very important part. And is any fear involved? You're going to see that there's a lot of fear involved, and we'll deal with that when we get to the fear form. So the big book says, now we look at this and we see we're in terrible shape. The things that people have done to us or that we've done to others or that they've done to others or that we've done to the world or the things that are going on that bother us are actually killing us. We have to get rid of them. How can we do it? Well, the first thing the big book says is we have to realize that people who have wronged us or other people are spiritually sick. Though we do not like what they did to us or what they've done to others, they, like ourselves, were spiritually sick. And they give us a prayer. We ask God, I'll use the exact words. We ask God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. It's not that easy to do, but it is easy if you think about it this way. There are all kinds of people in whom we know or we know about who do things uncontrollably because of physical disabilities. People with Tourette's, people with brain tumors will say and do things, or people in tremendous pain will say or do things that we discount. We don't pay attention to them as much because we know that they're suffering from this disability. you know, I was warned when I went to childbirth classes with my wife that there may come a time called transition, that deadly moment of transition, when she would curse me for having been around at conception and curse me for the harm that I had done to her. Now, it didn't happen, thankfully, but they said, don't worry, that's pain and hormones, and you know, it's not, she really loves you, okay? Well, you know, and there are people whom I know who are constantly in pain, and they drive me nuts sometimes until I realize, wait, they're in pain. They're in pain. So what this book, the big book, tries to persuade me and has persuaded me is that people who do wrong are in some kind of spiritual pain. They're spiritually sick, and there is something as deeply wrong with them as there is with those who have physical disabilities. And I know that to be true. I mean, I know that because I've done wrong things, and I know that I've always wanted to do right things, and I've done wrong things. And I know that when I've done wrong things, it's been a spiritual sickness in me. And I look at others, and I know that they're empty people. They're people who are unable to understand what it is sometimes to be human. The big book on page 552 has a story which tells about how a woman knew that she was going to go back to drinking after, I think it was 20 years of sobriety, maybe 12, because she hadn't gotten over her resentment of her mother. And she read an article by a minister who said, if you have a resentment that you can't overcome, pray for that person to have everything that you want out of life. Whether you mean it or not, pray for that person. And when I did that for Hitler. I first of all had to ask the question, what do I want out of life? I mean, isn't that the first question I have? If I'm going to pray for someone to have everything I want out of life, what do I want out of life? What do I want out of life? You know, when it comes down to it, I want some serenity. I didn't have serenity. I want to be useful in life. I want to have a sense that I am doing something that's useful. I want to be able to love, and I want to be able to be loved. I like those things. Those are the essence of what I want. I don't want money. If I could be loved and love, if I could be useful, that would be good. So I prayed for Hitler to be serene, to have ultimate peace, to have to be able to love and to be loved, and to be useful. And I saw that he had none of those. And most of the people who have harmed people in their lives do not have that. They do not have serenity. They do not have humanity. They are more and more, they're worse than animals, because animals at least do things out of instinct, but they have done things that go beyond what humans can do. And the more harm they do to others, the more harm they do to themselves, the more unable they are to be human. And I felt pity for them, absolute pity for them. Not for what they did. What they did was wrong and awful. But they were not human beings, and they defined themselves as not human beings when they did harm to other human beings or to others in general. I can tell you it's not easy, and I know that, but I can tell you that I have not suffered the same kind of harms that a lot of people in this program have suffered, but I have sponsored people who have suffered tremendous harms, you know, incest, abuse, physical and sexual as kids. And they have all been able to overcome that and feel the kind of tolerance, pity, and patience they would have for sick people, because they realize, A, that they must or they'll die, and B, that these people harmed themselves each time they did harm to the people I sponsored. And it's a very powerful moment. So I can only speak from their experience and not from mine. I mean, it's easy for me to talk about Hitler, right? But it's not easy for them to talk about the harms that they suffered, and yet they will tell you, if they were, you know, and they're speaking through me right now, that just being able to look at it that way really was able, they were able to change their lives. There was a particular lawyer who he had betrayed my trust, and he was an awful, awful person, and I really harmed me and my clients. And when I prayed for him to have serenity, usefulness, and all that, I realized, he's dead now, but he had four wives. His children from the first two set of wives wouldn't talk to him because of how he had treated their mothers. He was a smoker, a drinker, and he died at the age of 50-something. I felt pity for him. He had nothing. People thought he was wonderful, but he was living the double life, you know, and he was a sick person. And most people, when you look at them, they're sick. I mean, some are sociopaths and psychopaths. They are literally sick, and others make themselves sicker and sicker. And it's very important to remember that the more harm that someone does, the more harm he or she does to himself or herself. That's very important, because when we get to amends, what is the harm we may have done to someone? It's allow them to harm themselves as well as harm us. We have to figure that out and talk about that. I'll talk about that more later on today. So when we do that, the big book then says, now that we've dealt with the people who have done wrong, not the harms we've done, but the people who've done wrong, we can now put aside We can put aside our thinking about them. And the suggestion on the forms is that you then fold the form over so that you only have the fourth column, which is going to be the one I'm about to discuss, and the names of the people, institutions, and principles, and you fold over so you obscure the second column in which you've listed all the causes, and the third column in which you've listed the effect it has on you, the ambition, the self-esteem, and stuff. And then you ask yourself four questions. Where had I been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? Now, those are the four character defects that the big book isolates. Not gossip, not lust, not envy, not pride, but selfishness, dishonesty, self-seeking, and fear. And I want to talk about each one of them in turn, because I don't think they mean all that we, they don't mean the limited amount that we think the words mean. The word selfish, especially, is extremely important. Because it's defined in the big book in a way that's very different from any dictionary definition that you'll find. The way we use selfish in ordinary language is to mean wanting something for our own good. Right? I mean, that's basically the basic definition. I'm selfish. I want something. I don't care what effect it has on others. I want it to make me feel better. That's how we talk about selfish. I don't share because I want it, right? But the big book has defined selfishness very differently. In the discussion in step three, it discusses wanting to be the director instead of the actor, right? I discussed that yesterday. I discussed that this morning. Wanting to be the actor. I wanted to be the director. Wanting to be in charge of life and failing to be in charge. I discussed that a lot. That's what it calls selfishness. Whether your motives are virtuous or not virtuous, it is simply wanting your way as opposed to God's way. So selfishness from the big book perspective is clearly defined as being more than being wanting things my way for my own benefit. It may simply be wanting things my way for other people's benefits. It just means wanting things my way, wanting Lori's way instead of God's way, whatever God means. And once you understand that, then my selfishness in relation to Hitler is wanting the past not to have happened. Wanting people not to suffer. Now, that's not a bad thing, but it's killing me. So that's my selfishness, wanting things, at the very least, wanting things that have happened not to happen, or wanting things that are happening not to happen. That's a very basic level of selfishness, and that might be all that I have with respect to Hitler. Although it wasn't, because when I really began to analyze my selfishness, I wanted not to happen because for years it was something that I obsessed over. And it took time out of my life obsessing over it. So there was a part of me that is selfish in the ordinary dictionary definition. I wish it hadn't happened so I'd be more comfortable. You know, and I get that sort of sense of honesty, and I begin to realize, there are some, quote, selfish dictionary definition, selfish reasons why I wish Hitler hadn't existed. And it wasn't just my virtuous concepts. If I look at, ex-girlfriends, you know, I might realize that I thought I could change one of these girlfriends. You know, I thought I wanted her to be different. I thought love could change. Okay, I put that down. I also, once I got that down, I realized she was beautiful and it made me feel good having a beautiful woman at my side. And I used her for that reason. So you can see that I have both virtuous and non-virtuous motives mixed in. So you write down selfish. And selfish at the very least means you wanted things to be different. And at the most, you'll find other motivations. What does dishonest mean? Now, dishonest mean, the Big Book discusses the dishonesty in terms of the things that many of the alcoholics of the 30s did. Lying, cheating, stealing, and those are dishonesties. Those are the kinds of dishonesties that we often do. We might not be as dramatic, but we do lie, we do cheat, we do steal. But there are other kinds of dishonesties. One of the dishonesties that I think is really important for us to understand is that dishonesty is not telling the truth when the truth should be told. As people pleaser, as a people pleaser, I'm not saying any of you are, but chances are there are people pleasers in this room, we don't tell the truth when the truth should be told. And that's a form of dishonesty. We allow dishonest things to happen by not telling the truth. I should have said to, I can come up with all kinds of examples. I'm just trying to think of some generic things. I'm in a room and people say things, and I let them say things that are wrong. And I know that people are going to go out and act on those untrue statements. And I'm afraid and I say nothing. That's a dishonesty. It is a dishonesty, not telling the truth when truth should be told. And the third kind of dishonesty is not acknowledging reality, lying to myself. I mean, what I put down for Hitler under dishonesty was he died before I was born. The Holocaust was over before I was born. I was born in November of 45. The Holocaust was over in whatever VE Day was, which was, I think, May, wasn't it? June. Yeah, June, of course, because D-Day was June, something or other. Yeah, June. So it was over. That's a dishonesty. It's already happened. I can't change the past. And there's a dishonesty. I can't change my ex-girlfriend. She is who he is. She is who she was. She was who she was. I can't change that. I can't change other people. And so there's an inherent dishonesty in my wanting to have things different, right? So there's that kind of dishonesty. The third is self-seeking. And self-seeking, I think, is, if you look for definitions, you will not find help. Because self-seeking is defined as selfish, and selfish is defined as self-seeking. I think self-seeking basically is looking for my angle, looking for where it's all about me. This is how it made me feel. This is how they make me feel. This is searching for myself in things that are going around. How did the Holocaust, how did Hitler, self-seeking, I feel less of a person because I didn't fight or something like that. So self-seeking is looking at the me factor. It's the self-esteem. It's the aspect of thinking of me rather than of other people. Okay? And then fear. What am I afraid of? All kinds of fears will arise out of every one of my resentments. Fear that they'll find out if I've done something wrong. Fear of the consequences when they do find out. Fear that people will get worse. Fear that people will die. Fear that I'll never get over this ex-girlfriend or whatever. You know what I'm saying? Fear that I'll always be a vindictive person. Fear that I will continue to be traumatized by what happened to me as a kid. Okay? Whatever it is, that's the fear. I write that down. That's the resentment form. All the what-ifs and if-onlys of my life. And now, what I've begun to discover is the brilliance of the Big Book. The fear form and the sex conduct form now begin to deal with each one of those character defects. And I just discovered that the last couple of years. I don't know why I didn't see it before, but then you read something and you finally see words that you never saw before. Remember, you have selfishness, dishonesty, self-seeking, and fear. The fear form deals with fears. And you write down your fears. So I would write down, the first column in the fear form is you write down, say, Hitler. What are my fears in relation to Hitler? It can happen again. That's my basic fear. It can happen again. Not necessarily with Jews. It can happen with all kinds of people, but there can be outright killings. What's the resentment in terms of someone I gossiped about? He'll find out. You know? And there may be other fears. He'll find out that I'm jealous of him. Fear that I'm not as good as he is. You know, something like that. So you write down what it is you fear, and the second thing, why do you have that fear? So the first column, you write down all your fears relating to the person, institutions, and principles. You write that down in the first column. In the second column, you write down why you have them. And that is an interesting thing, because what you find is that often you'll be mixing reasonable concerns with unreasonable imaginations. You know, you may be afraid to walk in a particular part of your own city. There are parts of Winnipeg that I wouldn't want to walk in. But when I put that down, I might get a whole bunch of reasons for why I'm afraid to walk in that part of the city. They might come down to, well, there's crime there, and people have been hurt on the street, so I'm afraid of getting robbed. But then my imagination gets, and that's a reasonable concern. I mean, there may be more crime in that area than there is in where I live. Well, there is more crime in that area. On the other hand, most of it is people who know each other committing crimes against each other and not that random. But then my imagination gets a hold of me. I might be kidnapped by evil gangs. I might be tortured. They might hold me for ransom. They might find out my address and go after my kids. You know what I mean? Like, and it gets worse and worse because my imagination is a pretty big imagination. So once I put those down, I begin to, you know, my daughter's going on a trip. She's 19. She's not 19 now, but she was 19, say. What are my fears in relation to my daughter? She'll get lost. She'll have some bad experiences. You know, she's going to Europe. She may not be able to find a place to stay. She may be raped. She may be kidnapped. All of you start to worry about your kids, and they can go on and on and on. So you write them all down, and there's a wonderful feeling of release when you write them down, and there's also a wonderful feeling of identification as you begin to realize some of these fears are reasonable concerns, and some of them begin to border on the absurd. So once you write them down, you begin to see the spectrum of what your concerns are. Then the big book says, were you relying on infinite God or on your finite self? Well, I guess I was relying on my finite self because otherwise I wouldn't have that fear. Did it work? No, it didn't work because if it worked, I wouldn't have that fear. So there's little columns to check in, and they're givens. You're always relying on your finite self, and you always it didn't work. And then the question comes: you say a prayer, God, please remove this fear, this particular fear, and you name it, and direct my attention to what you would have me be, not do, but be. And the forum actually has a place for you. You say that prayer, and then you have a place to write out, what would God have you be? Now, the first time you do it, you may not figure out what God may have you be, and you may have to deal with that in your step five when you're sharing with another person. But ultimately, what the big book is leading us to is in relation to these things that concern us, what is the best we can be? What can we do? What can we be about this? What can I be in relation to my daughter who's going off on a trip to Europe at the age of 19? What can I be? The best father I can be? A loving person? A person who says, I'm there when you need me? You know, call me anytime. I worry, keep in touch because we want to be sure that you're safe. Tell us where you're going. But a father says, I can't manage her life when she's 3,000 miles away from me, 4,000 miles away from me. I can't manage her life. It depends whether you go the polar route or the, anyway. And then I lose my fear. The big book promises us that we outgrow fear. We do outgrow fear. We develop strategies instead. We begin to realize how we can be people who can handle situations the best we can, and we give up for those situations we can't handle. I mean, yes, my fear in relation to the place in town that I wouldn't walk in is I will be a person who is careful for the sake of others as well as for myself, that I don't go to places that are dangerous if I can avoid them. But if a three-year-old kid were in that place and called me up and said, help me, you think I wouldn't go to that place? Of course I would. I would be careful, a person who's careful, but I wouldn't be a person who just stayed away from it. I wouldn't have an irrational fear who would say, I can't go there. I would be a person who would balance issues. So every fear I've ever had, and I've had hundreds of fears, and every fear that I know sponsees I've discussed this with have had, has been outgrown by saying that prayer and figuring out what it is that God would have me be. Because if I live according to truth, love, justice, or beauty, or I live according to my deepest core beliefs, then I find that generally speaking, what God would have me be is the best I can be at this time. A loving, honest, compassionate person. A person who does his best to help others. And after that, it's not up to me. And then I lose my fear. I outgrow it. I don't outgrow my concerns. My concerns may still be there, but I outgrow my fear. They're now rational. They're rational concerns. It's a rational approach to things, and I outgrow them. And it's an amazing experience. And that's it for that form. It's a relatively simple form to fill out, but I can tell you that once you say that prayer and you write down or try to figure out what God would have you be, not do, but be, it's an amazing experience. Because you begin to realize that all you can be is the best person living according to the life that is your deepest core values. And once you realize that and that you're not in charge, you begin to realize, since you're not in charge, why worry? It's killing you and it's making you less able to do what you can do. You know, fear inhibits us from doing what we can do. But fear should teach us the limits of what we can do, and we should be able to stop there. Does that make sense? It's really brilliant. I think it is. So that's fears from that resentment form. We have selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and fear. We've dealt with fears right off the bat. Big Book says that's almost like a crime. It's just killing us. Fears are killing us. And then the other three we deal with under sex conduct. Now, what is sex conduct? Sex in 1939 was not... We think of sex these days as being almost purely the physical sexual acts. But in 1939, the word was much broader, and it meant relationships in which there was attraction. I can prove that by saying that the great humorists James Thurber and E.B. White wrote a book called Is Sex Necessary? And it's not just about sexual act, it's about relationships. So the word was used much more generically. And so if we understand that, the form itself says, okay, whom have we hurt? So we write down people we've hurt, and I write down any time in which there's been any attraction, either an imbalance of attraction, either me for another person or the other person for me. Because if there's an imbalance, it's going to be hurt. And I've written down ex-girlfriends, and I've written down people I've had crushes on who don't even know me. I've written down... some of you know that I no longer have it, this unreasonable fascination with Mary Tyler Moore and women who look like her. And I've met some people who look like her with the high cheekbones, you know, and I've become tongue-tied in front of them, and I've put people like that down. I put people I flirted with. We have a couple that we're best friends with, and early on in when I joined OA, I was flirting with the woman, and in relatively flamboyant ways, if I may say so, in front of my other good, very close friend and my wife. And we didn't mean anything by it in the sense that nothing would ever happen. We both loved our spouses. But that flirtation struck me as something a little off. So I put her down as well, plus ex-girlfriends, plus my wife. And then the question comes, the next column is, where had we been selfish, dishonest, and inconsiderate? Well, self-seeking is the other side of being inconsiderate, right? If you're thinking of yourself, you're not thinking of other people. If self-seeking is always thinking about your angle in it, you're clearly not thinking of other people, you're inconsiderate of them. So what you can see is that we've dealt with fears under the fear form, and now we're dealing with selfish, dishonest, and inconsiderate. We can almost copy, self-seeking, we can almost copy what we have from our resentment form onto that place, because the real purpose of this form is not to point it out again, it's to get on to the next couple columns. The Big Book asks us in relation to that, did we arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? We may have, we may not have. And then it says, where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? This is the key to that form. Because we begin to look at the relationships we've had or not had, the crushes I've had, that didn't have a relationship, but they were crushes. We begin to look at those and say, okay, what should I have done instead? And we figure out how not to have been selfish, dishonest, and self-seeking in relation to other human beings by looking at the very difficult relationships in which our bodies and our minds are somehow both mixed in. Because those are difficult relationships. Sexual relationships, attraction relationships are difficult relationships. So we're almost doing in a sense a dry run of how to deal with it in other relationships by looking at it for the more difficult ones of the relationships in which there's attraction. I find that quite brilliant, it's just amazing to me that it's right in there, but it's so consistent, that book, with this sense of we pick up selfish, dishonest, and self-seeking, and we put it right into sex conduct. Some people I know actually use that form for other kind of relationships, and I don't think it harms. It's just that's not the big book, but you can, and you can work it for any relationship. But whatever it is, the focus on that, the big book says, is to mold our ideals for the future. And to do that, we look at what we've done in the past, and we figure out what mistakes we've made. I mean, it's really that simple. So we're getting a very practical guide for living a different life by working through these forms. We've isolated four character defects: selfishness, deep; dishonesty, deep; self-seeking, deep; and fear, deep. We haven't isolated what we often hear of as lists. Have I lied to people? Do I feel jealous? You know, the seven deadly sins and the gossip and all that. Those are not defects of character. Those are actions that we've taken or feelings that we've had, from the big book perspective at any rate, that arise from our selfishness, self-seeking, dishonest, and fear. They arise from that. Why do I gossip? Like, I've written down a guy I gossiped about on my resentment form. Where was I selfish? I wanted to look better than he did. I wanted people to like me more than they liked him. I wanted to teach him a lesson for his arrogance. Dishonest? He's a sick man. Why am I making fun of a sick man? Self-seeking? To look better? Fear that he'll find out. So my gossiping was not a character defect. It was a result of my character defects, of my selfishness, dishonesty, self-seeking, and fear. And those of you who have used the forms, I'm sure you'll all agree, it's so much deeper. It gets right to the heart of who we are and why we are. We have four major character defects. We want life to be different. We can't acknowledge truth. We're always thinking about ourselves, and we're full of fear. And once we know that, believe me, step 6 and 7 are easy. Because if we get rid of those character defects, life will be a lot different from us. So that's the that is based. Oh, I wanted to. I'll just say one other thing. Just to go back to this sense of the big book says that we find that people have wronged us. That we very find that at some time in the past we've made a decision based on self that placed us in a position to be hurt. I just want to talk about what Joe and Charlie, the great AA speakers, say about that. Charlie talks about. He says, when I was a little boy, 8 years old, my father beat me black and blue. He said, no, 8-year-old boy, no one deserves to be beaten black and blue. But if 50 years afterwards, with my father now dead, I'm still hurt by that, then I have made a decision in the past that continues to allow me to be hurt. And I think that's an important fact. And I speak again from the experience of people who have been hurt far, far more than I have ever been hurt in my life. That they have made a decision to continue to be hurt, and that going through these forms has released them from that. And the dishonesty that they find in relation to that is not telling the truth when the truth could have been told, which may be much later on in life, or not acknowledging the truth that was one incident in their entire life and that they've had other good incidents or something of that sort. But it's very deep. So step 4, done the big book way, can be done within weeks. And that's such a promise, as opposed to some other ways that I know have taken people months, if not years. And the whole part of the big book that's really important to understand is that when you abstain in step 1 and you figure out what eating behaviors and foods you have to abstain from and how you're going to do that, you're in a race with time with your obsession. It's going to pull you back to those foods and those eating behaviors unless you recover by the end of step 9. So you're in a race, and the faster you do the steps, powerfully, but the faster you do the steps, the more you will not relapse, the more chance you have that you won't relapse and slip. So we'll leave it there, and we'll finish. That's step 4, and next is steps 5 through 7 in about 10 minutes. Thank you.